Decades after it was launched, NASA's Voyager 1 probe is still making news. The Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft were launched in the 1970s.
In the 1980s, they passed close by Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, making significant discoveries along the way. Now, Voyager 1 is sending back information suggesting that it is reaching the edge of the solar system.
It's already far beyond any planet, and it's about to leave the space that is influenced by the energy from the sun. Dr. Ed Stone is chief scientist of the Voyager space program. He has been since the beginning, and he describes the solar system as a kind of a bubble whose size is defined by solar winds propelled outward from the sun. This is a spacecraft that passed the last planet in the solar system more than a couple of decades ago, but is still within the solar system as you understand it.
It's still inside the solar bubble. That's correct. We're still bathed by the same solar wind that we have been for the last 30-some years. But once we leave the bubble, we will be, for the first time, surrounded by winds that came from the explosion of other stars.
When this was launched in the 1970s, did you anticipate the spacecraft lasting long enough that it would actually leave the solar system?
Well, we had hoped that, in fact, it would, and part of the original design of the mission was an interstellar phase, but, of course, none of us knew exactly how large the bubble was that we were inside, so we didn't know whether the spacecraft could last as long as it has. When the two Voyagers were launched in 1977, the space age itself was only 20 years old, so there was no evidence or experience that would suggest that they could last as long as they have.
Oh, now, wait a minute. You're saying that up until now, no one has known exactly how big the solar system is as you define it, the area that is covered by the solar wind.
That's correct. We have only had estimates, so we didn't know whether we were inside of a smaller or larger heliosphere. And that's because the size of the bubble is determined by this pressure of the wind blowing outward, pushing against the wind outside. And we don't know exactly, although we know a lot more today than we did 20 years ago, exactly how much pressure there is outside pushing back.
Okay, so just in terms of miles, if you can give me a figure, if we think of the solar system as this giant ball with the sun as a point at the center of it, how big a cross is it?
It's a comet-shaped object, so we're headed toward the nose of the comet. Voyager 1 now is 11 billion miles from the sun, and my expectation that is that it's probably at most another billion miles, and may in fact be only a few hundred million miles before we reach the edge of the bubble. We're getting very close now.
I'm just imagining an interstate road sign, 1 billion miles to go.
Right. That's 3 years for Voyager 1, 1 billion miles every 3 years.
And when you say it's comet-shaped and you're heading toward the nose of the comet, you're saying that 11, 12 billion miles, give or take, is the closest exit from the solar system. If you'd gone the other direction, it'd be much farther.
That is exactly correct. If we'd gone down the tail, it would be a very long journey to get outside into interstellar space.
And, of course, there is just immeasurable distances beyond the solar system.
Yes, that's correct. The two Voyager spacecraft will be orbiting the center of our galaxy, but very distant from any other object in the galaxy.
Is this boundary line that you seem to be approaching the last thing of interest that you can imagine Voyager encountering before it goes out of contact or goes out of service?
We want to explore interstellar space itself. We have some ideas of what's out there, but from observations from Earth, we believe that we're in a cloud of material that was ejected by the explosion of a series of supernova about 5 to 10, 15 million years ago, very near the sun, and that we will be embedded in the material from those giant explosions. And the magnetic field, which was swept up by the shells of material ejected by those exploding stars. So we're very interested in learning more precisely what's really outside of the bubble pressing back inward.
So you want to get out into interstellar space. Is it strange at all to think of the fact that you are exploring the farthest reaches of the solar system and trying to go beyond with the very latest in 1970s technology?
Yes, that's kind of peculiar that, in fact, we have instruments that were developed in spacecraft that was developed in the early 70s. The computers on board this spacecraft, it's a totally automated spacecraft. The computers have 8,000 words of memory.
That's, well, nothing.
Yes, it's nothing.
I mean, I'm sure many people have a smartphone that has far more memory than that
today. Oh, yes. They're measured in, you know, billions of words, not thousands.
Would you put any different equipment, obviously be better equipment, but would you ask for any different capabilities for this spacecraft if you were sending it off today on the same mission?
We would certainly have more up-to-date instruments, which are more sensitive. We would want to measure more of the energetic particles than we can. We did not cover all of the interesting energies, as it turns out. We can only infer some of what's out there, even with the instruments on Voyager. And there are many other observations with modern spectrometers that we could make of the environment out there that we can't make with Voyager.
What powers Voyager?
It's powered by the natural radioactive decay of plutonium-238 and thermocouples bolted to this heat source. A very simple, robust power supply. The radioactive decay half-life is 88 years, and that's one reason why the spacecraft are still working, is because we have a very long life battery, if you like. But we do know that our power level drops by 4 watts every year, and so we have to systematically turn things off one at a time. About the year 2020, we'll have to turn off one of the science instruments, and by 2025, we'll have to have all the science instruments off, and that will be the end of the mission.
So you have been tracking this spacecraft for coming up on 35 years now.
That's right, and we have our 35th anniversary of launch in 2012, and we still have a great journey to go.
You ever get bored waiting on it to reach the next thing?
Well, because we're exploring a part of space nothing has been before, every day we look at the data and we realize that it's even more interesting than we had imagined. That's one of the lessons from the Voyager mission, is that no matter what you think you know, what there is to learn is even more interesting.
Well, Dr. Stone, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Ed Stone is the chief scientist on the Voyager space program. Something about that music that just makes you want to talk that way. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
...2011 was a lousy year for a lot of businesses and many people seeking work. It was also, for some companies, a very good year, and that includes IBM, which turned 100 in June, and which is one of the success stories we're following this week. IBM stock climbed this year even more than Google and Apple. NPR's Ben Bergman explains why.
Don't just take my word for it. Here's what Warren Buffett announced on CNBC last month.
We bought about $10.7 billion worth of one stock, IBM.
You've bought over $10 billion in IBM?
Buffett's bet was surprising because he normally doesn't go near tech stocks, and no one was more surprised than IBM.
The company's finding out right now that you own 5% of the company.
Five and a half percent.
By you talking about this right now?
Right, I've not talked to the company.
So how did the third richest man in the world discover IBM? Well, he says he got the annual report in the mail and spent a Saturday reading it. What impressed Buffett is how much IBM has moved away from being a computer company. IBM managing partner Adam Klaber points out that his company sold its PC business 6 years ago.
There is no such thing as an IBM PC, and I think that really defines how we look at evolving and innovating as a company. As we saw that we're moving towards the end of the PC-centric era and that we wanted to move forward.
83% of IBM's business now is services and software. Sign a contract with Big Blue, and you get their consulting, their cloud computing, their servers, their analytics, even their financing. Bobby Cameron analyzes IBM for Forrester Research.
That's the game they're playing, where it's this broad set of technologies brought to bear, and it's very difficult for anyone else to pull all that together.
When the NYPD needed a system to track crime and better deploy cops, they hired IBM. When the telecom company Bharti Airtel wanted to build wireless coverage in 16 African countries, IBM. And why is this all-you-can-eat approach better than selling hardware? Because, as Cameron explains, being in the computer business just isn't very profitable anymore.
Over the last 15 years, the cost of an equivalent amount of computing has been reduced by a factor of 23. So it's 23 times cheaper. So a computer sale is no longer an individual component that all by itself can drive a lot of business value.
To find out what happened to companies that stuck to selling PCs, take a look at HP or Dell, which have seen their value plummet right alongside the price of computing. Meanwhile, IBM has become the one-stop shop of choice for many governments and companies.
Over the next 20 years, air traffic is expected to double. The systems that track, manage, and connect these flights weren't built to handle all that data. IBM's working with Boeing on a next-generation system to help integrate global air traffic more efficiently and in real time.
And more reasons investors are flying high on IBM? It's been aggressively building up its presence in the fastest-growing countries, China, Brazil, and India, where it says it will get 30% of its revenue in 4 years. In China alone, IBM has deployed 20,000 consultants. The company also named a well-liked new CEO who will take over next week, Virginia Rometty. Though its most famous employee still plugs into the wall.
What is Christchurch?
Yep.
Hedgehog Podge for 1200.
That would be the supercomputer Watson playing Jeopardy in February.
The Hedgehog and the Fox is an essay on this Russian count's view of history. Watson?
Who is Leo Tolstoy?
Yes.
And yes, in case you hadn't heard, Watson crushed the competition, delivering IBM another win this year. Ben Bergman, NPR News.
This is NPR News. We're reaching the end of a deeply mixed year for the U.S. economy. The unemployment rate ends the year at its lowest point since 2009, yet still very high, 8.6%. Many of the unemployed have paid the bills only by borrowing from family and friends, as we're hearing elsewhere in this program. Yet it was a year of economic growth, and for some people, businesses, and ideas, it was a breakthrough year. We're going to highlight some of them in a series of stories called A Good Year. It has, for example, been a good year for the digital cloud. Companies have advertised this concept in which you store your information in distant data centers.
This is the iPhone 4S with iCloud.
Powered by Amazon's cloud technology.
To the cloud with Windows Live to create and share anywhere.
So advertisers talk about it, but it can be a struggle to understand what the cloud really is. NPR's Wendy Kaufman went to look for it.
Clouds are often ethereal and beautiful, but this one has a lot of concrete and security.
This is a ballistics-grade door, so you could feel the weight of it, and so we'll open the door and then we'll pass through. Now, this
David Sabe, the owner here, is ushering me into a spotless Seattle-area facility the size of 9 football fields. It's crammed full of racks and racks of powerful servers, essentially sophisticated computers that serve up information to other computers. There are lots of blinking lights and wires everywhere.
Some of the compute cycles that are going on here could be providing a product for someone in Florida to Southern California to Alaska. So that's what a cloud looks like.
Well, sort of. Basically, the cloud is a fancy way of saying the internet. Lots of us have been using Yahoo or Gmail, so our email lives on the cloud, not on our computer. But email was just the beginning. This year, the cloud brought us something we didn't even know we craved, a digital storage locker. Think back to high school, where you stuffed that metal locker with books, homework projects, photos of friends, maybe even some music. But that music and everything else existed in only one physical place. You couldn't really drag that locker around. If you forgot to get something and went home for the day, you could try the "I left it in my locker" excuse. But now, that excuse just won't cut it. Here's why.
If I store my information online in one of these clouds, then it's as if I suddenly have a magic courier that will run and retrieve stuff out of my locker and deliver it to me instantly.
And, says Frank Gillette, an analyst at Forrester Research,
the idea of having this magic courier is remarkable.
The couriers have names like Apple, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and some upstarts like Dropbox. And this year, they ramped up their offerings and marketed them like crazy. They'll deliver ebooks, photos, music, and lots of other things from your cloud-based locker, and they'll make deliveries to almost any digital gadget. But businesses use the cloud differently. For them, the cloud can function a bit like a giant kitchen you can rent. Think of all those servers as ovens. In the past, companies would often build their own kitchens with enough equipment to prepare things they might only need once a month. But now, says Frank Gillette,
they don't have to have their own kitchen, or they don't have to have as big a kitchen.
A company might need one or two ovens or servers just for an hour every week to do its payroll. Or it might need 100 to manage a worldwide network of customer accounts. By using the cloud, companies pay only for the time and equipment they actually use. Businesses can also use the cloud for takeout. For example, instead of building their own accounting system, they can use a pre-made cloud-based one, and the results can be delivered right to their front door.
We literally charge our customers on a per-hour basis for the resources that they're consuming.
Brian Thompson is with a rapidly growing Seattle-area company called Tier 3. It helps companies use the cloud.
So we have customers that are spending less than $100 a month, and we have customers that spend close to $100,000 a month.
Whatever the figure, it's often less than a company would spend to do the task on its own, and it's often more convenient. Companies can also rent time to do projects on an almost unimaginable scale. This example comes from Adam Salipsky, a senior official at the part of Amazon.com, which provides cloud services.
We recently had a large pharmaceutical company who's our customer spin up 30,000 virtual servers to do mathematical modeling.
There are very few companies that could afford or even want to manage something that big. In so many ways, 2011 was a banner year for the cloud, and next year's cloud offerings are likely to be even bigger and better. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
You know those used plastic bottles that you throw in the recycle bin? Shampoo, milk, juice, laundry detergent? Where do you think they go? No, they're not like the socks. They don't get lost somewhere. One way they're being reborn is a sort of hard plastic lumber. Maybe you've seen them on park benches, right? Those park benches are not really made out of wood sometimes. They're used to build bridges now. They can make bridges out of plastic bottles that are strong enough to hold cars and trains and even tanks on military bases. You can squeeze or bend or crush a plastic bottle in your hands. How do you get those throw-out bottles to support so much weight? And what else could we build with this recycled plastic? Well, now joining me now to talk about this is Jim Kirstein. He is Chief Technology Officer and founder of Axion International in New Providence, New Jersey. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. How are you today?
How did you discover that these things would be good for making bridges and stuff out of it?
Well, you know, it really stems from all the bad publicity, and rightfully so, that plastics was getting in the recycling stream and more importantly in the waste stream. And we started taking recycled materials, working with Rutgers University here in New Jersey, and looking for things where we could take a negative, which was waste, into the environment and turn it around into a positive, which was developing long-lasting products that reduced maintenance, reduced planned obsolescence, and, you know, was really a useful thing. And so, again, in working with Rutgers and some other people, we started to advance this into railroad ties, bridges, military projects, marine projects, all that type of thing.
So do you actually start with the bottles and melt them down, or how does it begin?
There's now a whole collection process. Most people have some type of what we call curbside pickup, you know, where the bottles are put out and where the juice containers, detergent containers, all of that is put out at curbside. It gets collected. We buy certain types of material and put it together, and then you feed it through machinery and equipment, melt it down, and we can get it to take whatever shape we need it to, whether it's around marine piling, an I-beam type of design, interlocking tongue and groove boards, all different types of things.
So what do you mix it with? To make it stronger, there must be other additives, correct?
It's actually 100% recycled plastics. The key to the technology that Rutgers developed was to put together certain materials that are strong and rugged and tough, but that might not be stiff enough on their own. and mix them with other materials that are other plastics that are very stiff but might be too brittle on their own. And in the right proportions and through the right processing techniques, they yield all types of material, all types of combinations. We have 13 patents or patents pending that we work with here. And as you mentioned at the beginning of this segment, we've built bridges that hold 130-ton railroads and railroad cars, M1 Abrams tanks for the military, that type of thing. It's really pretty exciting stuff.
So there is a bridge in Maine, which I think, given the weather, you know, and because it's made out of plastic, I imagine it holds up to road salt and corrosion and things and rust much better than a steel bridge.
That is one of the beauties of this stuff. It's basically got an indefinite lifespan, which, as I said before, is a real negative if you're burying it or dumping it out to sea, as has been done way too often. But it's a real positive if you're using it to cut down on maintenance and increase the longevity of products and designs. It's pretty, again, that's what makes it exciting for us.
Is it the same stuff that we see on the picnic tables and the park benches?
Not really. You know, just like there's different types of wood, and ipe from a rainforest is not the same as southern yellow pine, composite building materials have various formulations. Ours formulations are designed specifically to impact infrastructure projects and allow us to do long spans and create the type of stiffness and strength that's needed to do bridges and marinas and that type of thing. It's not a negative reflection on things like park benches and picnic tables. That's great recycling, but it does not have the same type of properties that our materials have.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Jim in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi there.
My question was, I was wondering if there was any evidence for deleterious health effects that might be estrogenic or carcinogenic from maybe compounds that will leak out of the plastic, especially when in long-term structures that are put in water where those compounds might leak out into the water.
It's a great question, Jim. There are, you know, so many different types of plastics out there. The ones that we use are non-toxic. There's been testing done where our marine piles have been driven in to waterways where formerly creosoted treated wood and things were used, and it actually allows marine life to come back into the area because there's so little impact on the environment, so little negative impact. There's a lot of positive impact.
Could you, we talk about carbon fiber a lot now and making cars and things out of carbon fiber. Could you do it with plastics, recycled bottles instead? Could you make the bodies, you know, car bodies out of, instead of carbon fibers, plastic?
You know, the potential is there, Ira, for all kinds of things. We don't put any limits on ourselves, but for right now, our focus is on true infrastructure projects that again are looking for real long term benefits of the type that we can offer.
Could you actually run out of plastic bottles? If this really got going and a lot of bridges, and we know how much of the infrastructure is falling down all over America.
Sure, absolutely.
Could you run out of the raw material?
I guess that's always a possibility, but we would be at a business level that would be so positively impacting the U.S. at that point and worldwide. I mean, right now, only about 17% of all plastics are actually recycled. So there's a long, long way to go before we get to that point. There's literally billions of pounds of material that are generated each year that are not recycled.
Let's go to Richard in New York, New York. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
Hi there.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I have inspected a number of structures made out of your composite material, pilings and decking and what have you. Staten Island, there's a pier near where the Staten Island Ferry comes in that was constructed. They did pile postings. I'm a diver. I do underwater construction, demolition, inspection. And The product didn't stand up very well to the weather, you know, with the white fiberglass reinforcement rods with the black piling.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, Rich, as I said before, you're right. I've seen those same failed projects. There are a variety of composites out there. The project that you're commenting on specifically was not one that we did. Our projects have been in service. We have bridges built for the military that go back about 14 years. We have railroad ties in service for over a dozen years. I mean, and I'm talking here hundreds of thousands of them. So we know the longevity of our product and how it works. Again, it's like comparing different types of wood. Just because something is a composite doesn't mean it's the same as our composite. You know, we've recently won awards, R&D 100, for the top new projects of the year. And again, we're getting reorders from customers that have utilized our product for years and years.
Well, what is it about your process or product that makes it so much better?
It's just the type of it's just the material formulation, and I'm not saying that to put down any competitors or anything like that, but our material formulation was derived specifically to yield longevity and performance in just this type of application.
And if I'm a bridge engineer wanting to build a bridge out of one of your using your items, I don't need to know anything special or special training or anything.
Not specifically any special training. Every material is different. Concrete bridges aren't built the same as steel. Steel is not built the same as wood. So neither are composite bridges. But for instance, McLaren Engineering in this area, Parsons Brinckerhoff, Balfour Beatty, major engineering concerns have all designed with our materials.
All right, Jim. Thanks for taking time to talk about it today.
I appreciate it. Next time, maybe I can get on not after a Nobel Prize win.
We kept the audience for you.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
A great weekend.
Jim Kirstein is the Chief Technology Officer and founder of Axion International in Providence, New Jersey. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Misha Sarin and Anand and Leshu Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Neil Rausch, our technical director at the controls here in New York. If you missed any part of our program, go to iTunes. You can subscribe to our podcasts, audio and video, and we have a new improved SciFry iPhone iPad app, the SciFry B for Booster Edition. Go over to iTunes Store, download the SciFry B. You can find it there by searching for it. Also, we have an Android one in the works, so we'll be going along with that too. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. Merry Christmas to you. And have a happy new year. I'm Ira Flato in New York. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. If you haven't seen the TV show Breaking Bad, get it on your Netflix queue because at the center of the action is Walter White. He's the show's chemistry teacher turned meth maker turned anti-hero. This month, the Associated Press, Entertainment Weekly, even NPR's Fresh Air named the show as one of the top 10 TV shows of 2011. The show's fourth season just ended, and if you haven't seen it, you'll have a couple of months to catch up before the last season, season 5, gets started. And if you have seen the show, you know a bit about science. You've probably been pleasantly surprised about how accurate the science is. Well, that is no accident. Joining me now to talk more about it is the show's science advisor, Donna Nelson, in her day job as a professor of organic chemistry at the University of Oklahoma in Norman. She joins us from there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
How did you get such a good job like that?
Oh, it's just been amazingly fun. I'm a member of the American Chemical Society, and in its magazine, The Chemical and Engineering News, there was an interview of Vince Gilligan when he had first started the television show Breaking Bad. And in that interview, he was stating how important it was to him that he get the science right for the show. But he talked about how he didn't have that much of a science background, and none of his writers had an extensive science background, and so they were having to go to the web and Wikipedia in order to, get science content. And he made a statement in that article that he would welcome constructive criticism from knowledgeable sources. And in looking at that, I realized it was organic chemistry, and I've been here. This is all I've ever done is teach organic chemistry, and I thought, I can do that.
You can do
so
that.
I volunteered.
That's great. Let's play a clip from the show so people get a little bit of flavor, if they haven't seen Breaking Bad, about what's happening there. So let me cue that up now.
Monoalkenes, diolefins, trienes, polyenes. I mean, the nomenclature alone is enough to make your head spin. But when you start to feel overwhelmed, and you will, just keep in mind that one element, carbon. Carbon is at the center of it all. There is no life without carbon.
Now that is the teacher, the character Walter White, played by?
Yes, by Bryan Cranston.
Bryan Cranston. And that is sort of a tame part of the program where he's actually teaching chemistry to the class there, right?
Yes, that was one of the scenes in which he was actually teaching organic chemistry to the high schoolers. And that scene is very interesting, at least to me, because they appealed to me and said, we want to teach, we want to present him teaching about alkenes to these high school students. What would be appropriate for him to say? And they had written a few things, and there were, some errors. And I mean, that's, really basic organic chemistry. And so I just wrote them back a little bit about the nomenclature of alkenes and, tried to fill them in a little bit. And a lot of what I said was used in that very introduction. It was really amusing to see them, use the material. And at the end of that, they had said, well, is there anything that he would have written on the blackboard? And so I drew out some structures and sent them to him by email. And I was just amazed they drew up on the blackboard exactly what I had sent them.
Mm-hmm. Of course, this is a chemistry teacher who finds out that he can make a lot more money making methamphetamines using his chemistry knowledge than he can teaching school.
Yes, so he's a very good organic chemistry and organic chemist. He's an excellent organic chemist, and so he makes excellent meth. And I'm always very fast to say that that is not what we do in our labs at the University of Oklahoma.
Does he ever,
or in any of our classrooms.
Are you ever fearful that he'll give away the recipe, the real way? Does he ever give away the real way to chemically make meth in a lab on the show?
Oh, do they do that?
Yes.
Are you asking
do
that?
They, yes.
No, they don't. That was actually one of the concerns of a lot of people. But Vince Gilligan has been very clever. You know, there are multiple ways to make meth. And so although his scenes are very accurate, he will sort of kludge together parts of different syntheses so that if you just simply followed the one synthesis as it's presented, you wouldn't come out with methamphetamine.
Yeah, I've got another cut I want to play here that sort of gives a little bit more of the flavor of the show when on the darker side.
Okay.
They use reductive amination to yield methamphetamine, 4 pounds.
So no pseudo?
No pseudo.
So you do have a plan. Yeah, Mr. White. Yes, science.
That's what one of his drug dealers telling him that he's very happy to know science because it's making him a lot of money.
Yeah. And so, it's a very unusual show. And when this first came about and I had to decide whether I wanted to, try to assist them. Originally I was thinking, well, would I want to get involved in something like this? And then after watching a few episodes of the show, I realized this is not glorifying drug making at all because he has a very hard life,
Right.
I mean, starting out he was in his underwear in the desert and, the sand and getting scraped up, and then later he gets, beat up and shot at and all sorts of fights, and I can't imagine somebody looking at that and saying, yes, that's exactly the type of life I want to lead. So I thought, they're going to either have a hit show with good science portrayed or with bad science portrayed. And, of course, for scientists, when we see science portrayed badly, inaccurately on television or in the movies, it's like fingernails on the blackboard. So I thought, I'll help them. And, of course, I can't help them on the illicit meth scenes, the illicit meth lab scenes, but they get assistance from the DEA.
Yeah.
I'm not their only science advisor. They have many advisors, and I think I might have been the only one on the high school chemistry scenes, but they have many DEA agents right. helping them.
Let's go to a call from Mitchell in Chicago. Hi, Mitch. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Hi. I love Science Friday.
Thank you. Got a question for us?
Yeah, actually, I wanted to say I've always been interested in chemistry ever since I was little, but when I started watching this show, I decided to go back to college to study chemistry.
Wow. So that was an impetus, a catalyst, as they would say in chemistry.
Yeah. Yeah, catalyst.
That's actually wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful. I think that Vince Gilligan would be thrilled to know that his show is having that sort of an influence.
Thanks.
Yep, I can't wait for the next season. It's not coming soon enough.
That's the last one.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks, Mitch.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Is he really concerned? The producer is he really concerned about, you know, encouraging people to learn about chemistry on each episode? Does he have a little bit of real chemistry on it, or has that sort of gone away?
I think so. Yes, he really does, and he was very concerned about getting the science right. He was. I was really delighted to see this in him because, you know, for so long there's been this sort of a myth that you can't portray good science or accurate science and actually have an interesting show. And I think that this show proves that that is a myth. It is entirely possible to present science accurately and have a hit show. And I really hope that what he's done, and of course this has been done by other television shows, you know, CSI, et cetera.
Big Bang Theory.
But I hope that it will inspire others to follow his example.
So you must be sad to see it going into its last season then.
Yes, you know, it's been a wonderful show, but I really do believe that others will pick up where he's left off in this one aspect.
Do you believe that science is having sort of a rebirth on in the entertainment industry, on television, perhaps in the movies, with science movies and TV shows coming out?
Yeah, I think it perhaps is. I know that many of the scientists are trying to become more available now as science advisors, and the National Science Foundation is really trying hard to further this. And, you know, there have been even discussions in Congress about what we need is a hit television show that portrays good science. And that's been said for a long time. And, of course, like I mentioned, there are many shows that already fill that, such as CSI. But this is the first time that we've had one, I believe, on organic chemistry per se.
I would have never thunk it myself, having done so terribly in chemistry in my own lifetime, that a kid show would have been based around organic chemistry.
Yeah. Well, I say that, you know, it's a lifetime goal trying to teach organic chemistry to make it easy. And I'm starting to wonder if I'm ever going to achieve it in my lifetime.
His teaching,
but we do try.
Do you use the same teaching methods that he does in the front of that classroom?
No, not really. Of course, I'm teaching at the graduate level, and,
right.
and the chemistry that I'm teaching is more difficult. I'm teaching undergraduate and graduate both, but it's a little more advanced than what he gets into. His is really sort of a lower level, and when you get more to the higher levels, you have to teach more pattern recognition. It can't possibly be just straight memorization. I think the key to making it easier is the pattern recognition and, you know, relating just simple rules to be able to absorb the mass amount of material and draw patterns across the material. That's what will make it easier.
And what it makes this show interesting to viewers, I guess, is that it deals with the drug world, which a lot of people know a lot about, but it uses that as, so to speak, the catalyst to talk about the science itself.
Because yeah, I think that much of the science is so spectacular that, to me, it seemed to almost become a separate character in the show. And when I mentioned that to Vince, he said yes, that he thought that was the case. And so I don't know if he actually intended that from the beginning, but that's the way it's worked out, and I think it's wonderful.
So people would expect, like, a character to show up every week, right? You tune in to see what he might be talking about, what the science might be in that episode.
Yeah, a different type of science or a different little take on science, or you know, something interesting about science.
Yeah, just have,
I think it's been wonderful. It was just so much fun participating in this. I had a terrific time, and I would strongly recommend other scientists who are considering doing this to go ahead. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. And do you know what happens in the fifth season yet?
No, I don't. And even if I did, I wouldn't be able to tell you.
just between us. Thank you. And good luck to you. And maybe we'll see you on another TV series soon. Never know.
Oh, well, thanks. I mean, I would love it. It's been a terrific amount of fun. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nelson.
Thank you.
Donna Nelson, in her day job, is a professor of organic chemistry at the University of Oklahoma in Norman, and she joined us from Norman. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the annual Christmas bird count and all kinds of stuff having to do with birds. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
This week, we mark the passing of Jack Goldman, the creator of one of the great high-tech idea factories, one that Apple and other companies borrowed from, Xerox PARC. PARC, in this case, was an acronym. The Palo Alto Research Center is often remembered these days as the scene of missed opportunities, the cradle of other companies' babies. It gave birth to graphical user interface, icons and cursors, the mouse, the Ethernet, the laptop, things that Xerox didn't use, but other companies did.
Xerox hired Jack Goldman, a physicist, away from Ford Motor Company, to be its chief scientist. He quickly decided that what Xerox needed was a lab devoted to basic research, a place where lab nerds could pursue innovations and notions, where they could do pure science, insulated from whether it would result in products or profits. Goldman created that space. Physicist Ted McGirvin, who worked with Goldman both at Ford and Xerox, says Jack Goldman recognized there was a fundamental difference between research and development.
There's always a tension between a research laboratory and a development organization in any company, because there's nothing that somebody who is halfway through engineering a product would like to hear less than somebody coming in the door and saying, I've got a totally new technology which will totally change the product that you have half designed.
Goldman is credited with bringing in brilliant scientists and making sure that they had resources to explore big ideas. The lab did have some money-making results, but Goldman knew there were missed opportunities. The laptop, networked computing. In an interview 6 years ago, he said Xerox had it all in the palm of their hands, and it was frustrating sometimes to researchers when the company let it go.
They were so disappointed when Xerox was not prepared to bring it out right away in the mid-70s.
Goldman did take satisfaction in the fact that Xerox PARC inventions eventually got out into the marketplace. Ted McGirvin says it was one of the most important lessons he learned from Goldman.
There's no limit to what you can accomplish if you don't care who gets the credit.
Jacob Jack Goldman was 90 years old.
This is NPR News.